The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Our new Civics 101 podcast launched on Inauguration Day with the goal of answering questions about how our democracy works. All that stuff you should have learned in middle and high school, but may have forgotten. Today, a look at covering the White House with Scott Horsley, our guide on the inside. He's NPR's senior White House correspondent. He's been on that beat since 2009, so he knows a thing or two about what goes on in the White House briefing room. Freedom of the press is a bedrock of our democracy, but there's no specific call for a White House press corps in the Constitution. So I asked Scott how he envisions his role.
Well, you're right. There is nothing in the Constitution that says that there ought to be 49 seats in close proximity to the Oval Office for D.C.-based reporters. But right there in the First Amendment, the founders were very much aware of the importance of a free press and the watchdog function that we play. And we see our role as being the eyes and the ears of the American people who can't physically be there and don't have the time to be there in a watchdog role for themselves. So we're there watching for all the people who want to know what the president and his team are up to.
What's a typical day for a member of the White House press corps?
Well, there's no such thing as a typical day. Every day is different, and certainly the opening days of any administration are particularly interesting and volatile. And at some point, that kind of opening frenzy will, we hope, settle down just a little bit. And then it's, you know, there's a rhythm of the president doing kind of public events where he's making a statement, meeting with people on camera, sort of trying to make a point through his persona. Then there are private closed-door meetings, sometimes with lawmakers, sometimes with members of his cabinet, to influence the direction of legislation or influence the direction of regulation. We've seen this president saying he wants to roll back regulations in a big way. We've seen him talk about trade in a way that's maybe at odds with members of his own party on Capitol Hill. So we're still sort of trying to sort out, you know, which of the statements that he made on the campaign trail and which of the statements he's made in the White House are going to prove out.
But you do show up, like your colleagues, every day at the White House press corps briefing?
Well, at NPR, we have, during the Obama administration, we had three of us who covered the White House. We've upped that a little bit to have four of us covering the White House in the Trump administration. So not all of us show up every day. Maybe one of us will be there physically at the White House. Another one might be out in the country somewhere talking to voters. One of us might be back at headquarters monitoring executive orders that the president's put out. So there's a lot to keep an eye on, but one of us is certainly there. Our seat in the press room is not quite front, but center. We're in the second row center seat, so we're not quite a front row seat, but a prominent seat to kind of watch the daily briefing.
So at that daily briefing, what don't we know or see that goes on?
Well, you can see it all. I mean, for better or worse, the daily briefing, at least ever since the Clinton administration, has been on live television. Mike McCurry, the press secretary in the Clinton White House who allowed that to be a daily televised event, has sometimes said that was his biggest mistake. And there are plenty of us, I think, who would agree, because once they put it on camera, for all the gains in transparency and civic education, it unfortunately sort of turned the daily briefing into less of an exchange of information and a more of a kind of a piece of performance art, where you have a lot of the reporters and the press secretary kind of posturing for the TV cameras and the audience on cable news or on C-SPAN. But what you don't know, I guess maybe is, if you don't follow it regularly, maybe just how little actual information is conveyed at those briefings. They run, typically in the Obama era, they ran about an hour, and it was often sort of the least informative hour of my day. I might learn more making phone calls or, you know, reading position papers or talking to people behind the scenes. But what it is an opportunity to get a spokesperson for the president on camera, on tape, saying something.
But that is a criticism about the White House press briefing daily, that there is no real news made there. I'm going to go further with critics saying it's a stenography pool at the White House press corps, passing on whatever talking point the administration is on for the day. They're rarely covering real news. And now presidents have Twitter to get their message out. So what is your case, Scott, for why the White House press corps matters and is necessary?
Yeah, I mean, there's kind of a lot going on in that question, as the press secretary himself might say. we do get critiqued for being stenographers. We don't see that as our role. On the other hand, I sometimes get criticism that I don't do enough stenography. And it's interesting. The people who are making those criticisms have changed a lot with the change of party in control of the White House. When Barack Obama was in the White House, there were Democrats who thought I should maybe just pass on more of what the president and his staff said in an unfiltered way and more uncritically, while Republicans would complain that I didn't challenge them more. Now it's just the opposite in terms of the party that's doing the complaining, the party that wants more stenography. But no, our role is not simply to write down what the president or his spokespeople say and then pass it along unfiltered or uncritically. It is to probe and to examine and to also hold it up to other pieces of evidence. You know, if Sean Spicer comes out and says this is the largest crowd to ever witness a presidential inauguration in history, period, it's our duty to say, well, here are some other pieces of information that contradict that, in this case, flatly disprove what the press secretary said. There are lots of cases that are not as black and white as that, where, you know, the administration will argue that XYZ has happened in the economy, and, you know, you might say, well, that is either because of or in spite of or partly because of and partly in spite of some action that the administration has taken. So it is part of our role is to certainly listen to what they have to say, hear them out, but also challenge, probe, and introduce other information, try to provide context, try to provide meaning.
What kind of relationship do you want to have with the White House press secretary? Obviously, you're trying to vet their information that they're putting out there. And as you said, you're there for the American people.
Yes. And the relationship is necessarily adversarial. It's adversarial by design. We're not supposed to just be tools of the White House. But on the other hand, it doesn't have to be ugly. It doesn't have to be hostile. It can be businesslike. We certainly had adversarial relations at times with the Obama administration. I spent part of that time serving on the Correspondents Association, which is sort of the liaison between the working press and the White House. And we certainly had complaints about usually restrictions on, you know, what press access might be to the president or his aides, or, you know, the terms under which information was distributed. We certainly had an adversarial relationship at times, and it's the nature of the job that you're always pushing for more access. The White House staff is always sort of pushing to control their message. It has been somewhat more adversarial in the opening moments of the Trump administration, but we had some encouraging signals during the first formal briefing on Monday that Sean Spicer understands that it's in no one's interest if we're just in open warfare. It doesn't help them to always be openly fighting with the press corps, and it doesn't help us if we can't get information from the White House staff. You mentioned Donald Trump's Twitter feed. As technology has evolved, presidents have had more of an opportunity to spread their message over the heads of or without going through the filter of the White House press corps. That's not absolutely new. You could say that Franklin Roosevelt's fireside chats were a way to reach out directly to the American people on the radio without having to go through the newspaper reporters who dominated the press corps at that time. Barack Obama was masterful in circumventing the White House press corps through the use of the White House website, his own video news releases. And so what Donald Trump is doing with Twitter is different in degree, maybe, but it's not different in substance.
All right. I've got a logistical question about the press briefing room. How does the seating work? Does an administration assign correspondents to certain seats or first come, first serve?
For most of the period that there has been a press room, the White House staff has found it to their advantage not to assign the seats in the briefing room, but to let the reporters themselves make that determination of how the seats would be assigned. Early in the Ronald Reagan administration, Larry Speaks did do the seating assignment himself. That was Reagan's press secretary. But most press secretaries after that have decided it's better to let the reporters themselves decide how to allocate the seats. But if the Trump administration decides to shake that up, they may try to do that. We'll see.
Well, as president-elect, Donald Trump did shoot down Jim Acosta, the CNN reporter. If there are threats of being evicted or being chastised publicly by the president, is that going to have a chilling effect on the kinds of questions that White House correspondents ask in those briefings and in other situations with the press?
Being excluded from a press conference would certainly have a chilling effect. And the White House Correspondents Association has said that we would object strenuously if now President Trump or any of his aides tried to exclude working reporters from either the briefing room or from, you know, presidential press conferences. Being ignored by the president or even being chastised or belittled by the president won't necessarily have a chilling effect on the press corps. We're grown-ups. We have thick skins. We're used to being berated by our by our listeners, by our readers, by the politicians we cover. So the fact that Donald Trump engaged in sort of a shouting match with Jim Acosta of CNN, that was maybe more visible than what we usually see in the decorous presidential press conferences or news conferences by president-elect. But that in itself, I don't think, will have a chilling effect. There have also been questions about, you know, how the rest of the press corps responded when then-President-elect Trump refused to take a question from Jim Acosta.
Right. There calls been for some solidarity. Everyone else should have asked the question, that kind of
some
thing.
Some who have suggested that we all should have asked Jim's question for him. I don't necessarily disagree with that, but as one of my colleagues, Glenn Thrush, formerly of Politico, now with the New York Times, pointed out, Barack Obama always came to a press conference with a list of reporters that he planned to call on, and he generally stuck to that list, and other reporters could jump up and down and raise their hand, and the president didn't call on them. He didn't make a scene of it the way that Donald Trump did in with Jim Acosta, but there was never some expectation that, you know, every reporter had a right to ask his question of the president, or if denied that right, that other reporters then had an obligation to ask that question for him or her. So, you know, it may at times be a useful strategy, and we may occasionally adopt that strategy. But it's always been the case that presidents call on some reporters and don't call on others.
So, Scott, you are not an academic or a civics scholar, but as a practitioner, what is the most important thing that people should know about the role of the White House press corps? The big takeaway.
We are not here to influence the outcome of a debate or to play favorites or to help or hurt the president or his team or members of Congress. We're here to cover the news.
And we are so glad that you are there to do it for us. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure.
NPR's senior White House correspondent Scott Horsley giving us a primer on the White House Press Corps for episode 2 of Civics 101. You won't miss a single class if you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Google Play by searching for Civics 101. On January 20th and 21st, the National Mall in Washington, D.C. was packed for Donald Trump's inauguration on Friday and the March for Women's Lives on Saturday. Trump and his press secretary asserted that they got the largest crowd ever to witness an inauguration. PolitiFact graded that as a pants-on-fire distortion of the truth. Still, despite official estimates, off-the-cuff guesses, and even aerial photos that look hard to dispute, determining the actual numbers of those crowds is no easy feat. How do you measure a giant shifting mass of thousands and thousands of bodies? One nonpartisan company that provides crowd estimates is Digital Design and Imaging Service Incorporated. Reporter Sean Kapten dug into their work and the complicated science of crowd estimates for Fast Company. Sean, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Great. Thanks for having me.
So DDIS, I'm going to use that for stand in for Digital Design and Imaging Service Incorporated, hired by two media organizations to provide crowd counts for the Women's March on January 21st, pretty confident of their count of 440,000 people at the DC March anyway. but said they could not be as confident measuring crowds during the inauguration. Now, why can they not? It's same space, same weekend.
It was a bad day, really, for measuring both events, but especially for the inauguration. There was heavy cloud cover, which made satellite imagery impossible. That was used pretty effectively with President Obama's inaugurations. Also, the inauguration is essentially a no-fly zone, so flying a drone or, as DIS does, a balloon over the area wouldn't have been permitted. So there's really no way to get an aerial view of the inauguration.
So they use satellites, they use drones. Tell us more about their methodology. How do they actually measure crowds?
Yeah, DDIS relies mainly on balloons because they can fly at about 600 feet or so, which gives them pretty high resolution photos of the crowd. They do a lot of aerial surveillance work in different areas, but in terms of crowd counting, their first major project was Glenn Beck's Rally for Sanity in 2010. In which they did a pretty accurate crowd count for CBS News that came in way below what the organizers had estimated. Estimates, which I think were pretty back of the envelope for the organizers, were between 300 and 650,000 people. DDIS came out with 80,000. And pretty much everyone who's anyone in the crowd measurement and science world was 100% behind DDIS's methodology. They said it was very sound.
So companies do use this aerial imagery to determine a crowd size. What happens? How do they account for tree cover or buildings or shadows or other visual obstacles?
Yeah, one thing that's important to do a good crowd count is you have to have scouted the area and understand it well ahead of time. So you have a sense, for example, of how much obstruction there is in certain areas. The counting is done by dividing an area into grids. And so you can get a sense of grids that have trees, may have fewer people, or they may have more people. Say it's a sunny day, for example. You can assume certain kinds of behavior of people depending on the weather, depending on the topography. So you kind of have a sense ahead of time how much each area can hold. And then there's also some science around how big a crowd can be before basically it becomes untenable, because people start crowding so tightly that it becomes uncomfortable and even dangerous. So you kind of have an idea of what areas of a segment, how many people they can hold overall, and how many they're likely to hold, given how long people are there and what people can tolerate, essentially.
There were some reports I saw from the Women's March that people couldn't actually move around, or they didn't have any place really to go. Was it nearing that danger threshold?
There are various levels of discomfort. It's something called the Fruin scale of service. But there are different levels. There are a point at which basically you're pretty cozy with people, but you're probably not at a point where you're going to get freaked out by it. I'm guessing is they did not go beyond that point, because I didn't hear about any incidents of any types of injuries or any type of panic happening. Because at a certain level, you get to a point where if someone moves or panics, you could have something like a stampede, which is a constant concern, say, at the Hajj in Saudi Arabia, for example. And they've actually been employing some crowd science around that to try to head off situations where you could have a stampede issue. Clearly, we didn't get anywhere close to that at the Women's March.
What is the margin of error for this kind of count? Is there any way of corroborating the numbers and verifying them?
There, in the Women's March, it was fortunate that two bodies had actually done counts. The other one had been Manchester University in the UK. They used a slightly different count. It was based a lot on this level of service, this Fruin scale, of understanding how many people could logically fit in an area. They did also, towards the end of their work, correspond with DDIS, basically sort of check each other's methodology. Manchester came up with 470,000, which is really close. And when I spoke with Kurt Westergaard, who's the president of DDIS, he said, you know, that's within 10%. He said that made him feel very confident. So you can't say down to the person. In an event this big, you can't even say down to the 1,000. People, but if you're getting within 10% of something, you've got a good sense of the magnitude of an event, and that's really the best you can hope for.
There are vested organizations who also came up with their own crowd estimates. As we know, you know, Donald Trump said he had this much of a crowd. The Women's March organizer said X amount for both the inauguration and the Women's March. So how did they come by their numbers?
Donald Trump, from what I've heard, basically came by what it looked like to him. He's not a crowd scientist, for example. Also, the perspective, and I used to live in D.C. I've seen the perspective from the steps of the Capitol, you know, where he was speaking from, you can only see so far. And the area right in front of the Capitol was absolutely packed. And that's basically pretty much all you see when you're there. So he saw, you know, a sea of people that looked like it extended onto the horizon, but he was not seeing most of the area. I wouldn't put really any stock in what he could see. Even if you were an expert, he just wouldn't see it very well. The Women's March, they did a lot of organizing on Facebook, for example, also on some other event-based sites like Eventbrite, for example. So they were making estimates largely by what they had in terms of people who had said they were going to go and then after the event confirmed that they had gone. Their estimates were a little optimistic in some places. For example, in London, they probably were pretty far over what would have been practical. I spoke with researchers there. They were figuring maybe around 50, 60,000 people. London said 100,000. In Austin, based on Facebook, they estimated 38,000. And both the Austin police and Manchester came up with 50,000. So in some cases, they seem to have been pretty close. In other cases, they might have been a little optimistic or even very optimistic. And again, you know, just like Donald Trump, there's a potential to, one, exaggerate maybe for political reasons, and two, just because they're not experts and they don't really know how to do it.
My guest is Sean Kapton. He researched and wrote for Fast Company about measuring crowds or crowd science, when size really does matter in the case of measuring crowds. You mentioned Austin for the Women's March. Much of what I saw was actually March, whereas in D.C. and other places, it looked a little bit more static. Tell me about the science of counting a moving target rather than a static event.
Yeah, things get radically much more difficult when you're trying to count a moving target. The D.C. one was obviously one good example. People had congregated on the National Mall for a rally, and then they marched mainly up Pennsylvania Avenue, but also up some other streets like 15th Street to get near the White House. So then the question is, what part of it has to be, you know, when do you look at a crowd? Do you look at it as it's amassing? Do you look at it at its sort of peak before it starts marching? Do you look at the march? Do you look at both the beginning point and the end point and try to get some photos in between? So you get a lot more margin for error. An example in D.C., what they did was they basically picked the point at which the march was filling up Pennsylvania Avenue pretty well on its way to the White House, and they had a good view over both the mall and Pennsylvania Avenue and most of the other streets as well. So they could pretty much see, you know, more or less everyone. And there's some science around understanding if you can't see a certain region, for example, but you have a sense of how many people it can hold, you know, you can make a guess for who's in those areas you can't see. It's nowhere near as exact when people are moving.
So given the cloud cover, especially on Inauguration Day, will we ever really know the exact number, size of the inauguration crowd?
Nowhere near. There are some other ways to get a sense of magnitude. Keith Still, who's a professor of crowd science at Manchester, was hired by the New York Times to do just to look at photos of the Obama inauguration and the Trump inauguration. And he made a rough estimate, you know, with some science and some guesstimate, that the crowd at the Trump inauguration was about a third as large. And we have figures for the Obama inauguration, although they vary a lot as well. So we at least know it was, based on his assessment, it was a lot smaller. But anything beyond that, you really can't say for the Trump inauguration.
Well, just looking at the photos, that seems pretty clear.
It does seem pretty clear. I mean, there's always a question of when were the photos taken? You know, was it, you know, 45 minutes before the inauguration, the oath of office starts? How many more people would trickle in, you know, in time for that? Were people running late? So there's some dispute about when the photo was taken, but pretty much every photo at any time, you know, shows a big discrepancy. Clearly, the Trump inauguration looks smaller by any measure. There's also measures of how many people took public transit, and it was considerably larger for both the Obama inaugurations and for the Women's March the following day.
It still sounds pretty imprecise. I mean, it sounds like weather forecasting. Any hope that we will see advances in crowd counting science by inauguration 2021?
There could be. I spoke with researchers at the University of Central Florida, and they're using more image recognition and algorithmic counting of crowds. They can do some interesting things. In crowd counting, currently, you have to, at least to an extent, count heads. Now, not in every single part of the image, because obviously you'd go insane trying to do that. You know, you divide the area into grids, and you get a sense, you know, so many grids X, Y, and Z can hold about the same number of people. So if you count X, you have a sense of Y and Z. But there's obviously limitations to that, and especially if you're doing it by satellite, which in some cases, it's like the inauguration is really your only way to get an overhead view. You know, you're getting down to the point where, you know, an individual head might be one pixel. And that's just too low a resolution. But with some image recognition and study algorithms, you can basically start counting things that a person can't count. And part of it is, for example, you train the AI on blurry images. But you know how many people are there. You know, you have this what they call a ground truth. And you see how close the algorithm comes to that. And you keep training it until basically even when you can't make it out visually as a person, you're getting from whatever points of light and dark and even sort of frequency, you know, of light and dark and color, you can judge from that how many people it is. So basically, a computer can recognize really subtle signs that a human can't recognize. So there's hope that it can become more accurate and also a lot faster. You know, they can do it maybe in a half hour, whereas today's methods can take days.
Sean Kapton, contributor to Fast Company, thank you for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
You can find big crowds at protests and political rallies. Another place where the masses congregate? The dance floor.
Ready for action, nip it in the bud, we never relaxing. Outcast is everlasting, not clashing, not at all. But see, my want to do a little acting. Now that's for anyone asking. Give me one pass, some drip, drip, drop, there it goes.
You're listening to the voice of Big Boi, who along with Andre 3000 forms the multiple Grammy Award-winning hip-hop group Outkast. Their brand of wordplay, gospel, and funk redefined the sounds of the South in the mid-1990s and crossed over to mainstream audiences in the early 2000s. While Outkast's impact on hip-hop is undeniable, a college professor thinks the duo's relevance transcends that genre. Regina Bradley is associate professor at Armstrong State University in Savannah, Georgia. And this semester, she's teaching an upper-class English course called Teaching Outkast and the Rise of the Hip-Hop South. Dr. Bradley, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me. Yay, I didn't want you to turn off the music.
Boy, I wonder what class must be like.
I'm telling you.
Well, you are a longtime fan of the group, but how would you describe the band to someone who doesn't know them?
I would be like, you don't know Outkast? That'd be my first response. Second response would be, so Outkast is one of the most iconic Southern hip-hop groups, and they're iconic, one, because of their music, but also because they were the first recognized Southern hip-hop group in the early 1990s to kind of break through. You know, it wasn't like a, hey, welcome. It was they were literally booed off the stage at the Source Awards in 1995. So they paid their dues.
Well, why? Because Southern hip hop was not yet recognized?
Well, because a lot of folks, especially folks in New York, thought there was no such thing as Southern hip hop, let alone any kind of hip hop outside of New York. But, yeah, I mean, like, they fought to be recognized not only as a legit hip-hop group, but also they talked about things that were relevant to Southern folks. And a lot of the issues and concerns that they were talking about didn't translate in the same way as they did for New York. So if you were from the South and you're talking about Atlanta, which at that point was not known as the transient city that it is today, it was on the cusp, if you will, then, of course, they're like, oh, Atlanta's still country and it's backwards and Black folks in the South, they don't know anything about hip-hop because hip-hop is considered urban and slick and full of wordplay.
Well, and they really made it. There's this song, which is now, I would say, a staple at weddings and home dance parties.
Y'all don't want to hear me, you just want to dance.
That's Hey Ya by the band Outkast, and we're talking about a class that our guest, Regina Bradley, an assistant professor of African American Lit at Armstrong State University, is teaching this semester. Well, Regina, you mentioned the regionalism, that Outkast is from the South, but what makes this band worth studying?
Well, I think it's really fascinating how they move their ideas and articulation of Southerness out. So when you first introduce to them on their first album, which is titled Southern Playlistic Cadillac Music, they're talking about the city of Atlanta, and Atlanta is kind of central to their idea of the South. And then on their second album, which is ATLians, they start to move away from that kind of geographically located idea of Southerness. And then they also are kind of clapping back, if you will, at being rejected at the Source Awards. So they have ATLians, and then when they get to Aquemini and Stankonia and eventually Speaker Box Love Below, their ideas of Southerness is more of a cultural concept instead of something that's geographically located, which often when we have these conversations about Southerness, we kind of try to stick to the physical region of the South. But what Outkast does so beautifully and also with really great experimentation is that they move or force the audience to reconsider what they think Southerness is using their music. The Pope and the Soaps got us under the scope, but for unknown reasons, because we don't sell dope that you distribute, we don't contribute to your clandestine activity. My soliloquy may be hard for some to swallow, but so is Carl Liver Orr. You went behind my back like Ludo when he cut up all the poor. Two things I hate, lies and thieves, they make my blood boil. But what constricted on my soul that they call wheels of steel. You see that transition really well, kind of marking through their catalog as it develops.
Speaker Box Love Below, that is a double album. That did that one win the Album of the Year Grammy?
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember.
It was the first rap album to win Album of the Year back
huge,
in 2004.
Huge success. Have you had a lot of students sign up?
We currently have 20 students. The class was full by the second day of registration. So I'm like, y'all love me. Y'all really love me.
Now, would anybody who doesn't know the band want to take it?
So I do have a couple of students who are like, I have never heard of Outkast. So I'm like, oh, so you really took the class because you love me, right? So, I mean, ultimately what it is it's a popular culture studies class using literature as kind of the foregrounding for that analysis. So I have students who are like, I don't really listen to Outkast or I don't really listen to hip-hop, but they wanted to come in and try something different. They wanted to kind of see what all the hubbub was about. And I think that's really great. And I also try to make sure that those students are comfortable when we have these conversations as well.
One of the things that I hear in the band is a kind of vulnerability and openness about love and respect for women, at least in their later work. I'm thinking of the song Mrs. Jackson, which is about the mother of Andre 3000's partner, Erykah Badu. After they broke up, he's apologizing to her. So how do you think they fit in those frequently well-deserved charges of misogyny in hip-hop?
So Dr. Treva Lindsay has a term that I absolutely fell in love with when she told me. It's called melodious misogyny, which means that there's these really horrible things that are being said about women, but it sounds so good, so we'll give it a pass, right? And I'm not here to say that Outkast is perfect. By far, they're not. They definitely have misogynistic moments, and it might be that kind of lower-level misogyny. But what I really can appreciate about them, and this is something that I write about in my book, is that you can see a development of their ideas and attitudes towards women shift, right? So if you look at Southern Playlistic, Cadillac Music, and you look at ATLians, Jazzy Bells, for example, there's a particular type of respectability that black women have to have that they were seeing, or that they felt that a lot of young Southern black women didn't have. And then you have, like you were pointing out, in Stankonia with Miss Jackson, so now you have families, right? This is the post-Badu moment for Andre. And you can kind of see that influence. Big Boy has a daughter now. He's married, right? So you can see that kind of influence. And then when you think about the Love Below, it's almost like it's an existential question of where Andre fits into the experiences of black women, because he samples his mother. He interviews his mother. He talks about God, if God was a woman. He talks about all of these things that focus on the experiences of black women, and probably most importantly, uses their voices to do so.
I was scuffling going to school, I was scuffling and working at night, and you know what? I truly believe, and that's why I tell a lot of parents, single parents, don't tell me what God can't do. I made sure you had. I never felt like
to be deprived of anything. If a man didn't want to take care of his child, you move on. And that's what I did. I moved on.
It's interesting, you know, that kind of continuous development of what they think of where women fit into their own narratives, but also allowing room for women to speak for themselves, literally speak for themselves on their albums is really important.
So this is a hip hop band that crossed over, right? So what does that do for the understanding of the band, or does it take away anything in your mind?
Well, one thing that I think about is when they did their reunion tour in 2014, their first performance was at Coachella. And I was so bummed that I couldn't go because Coachella.
Sunshine, California, spring, great outfits.
Yep, and a whole lot of money to get there.
Right.
And they went through their entire catalog. They went from album to album to album. And the one thing that I saw as I was watching, because clearly I had it on my, you know, full speaker blast system in my house, listening like I was at Coachella. But after they performed Speaker Box and The Love Below, which they hadn't done because they stopped touring after that album, people started leaving. And I was like, what are you doing? Why are you leaving? Because folks weren't familiar with anything really before Speaker Box and The Love Below and Hey Ya and I Like the Way You Move, right? And I think that that's particularly important, how they're being remembered in popular culture. And it's unfortunate if that's the starting point for a lot of folks, which it really is, because arguably, I mean, they had crossed over before, but I mean, the Duel album made them a pop culture sensation. Like, everybody's like, oh, it's Outkast. But it's kind of unfortunate because they did so much great work beforehand. And I think that part of their legacy is kind of overlooked in favor of the Grammy Award-winning Outkast.
My relationship with my folks is give and take, and I done took so much, not giving my glory. To have a choice to be who you wants to be is left up to me, and my mama damn told me.
Dr. Regina Bradley is with us. She's teaching a course about the hip-hop duo Outkast at Armstrong State University in Savannah. So this is an American Studies course, and you said this is the literature of Outkast. So what's on your syllabus? Are you breaking apart, deconstructing songs?
Yeah, so one of the first activities that we do in every class is they do a critical listening activity. So I pick a song from the album that we're focusing on for that unit, and we listen to it, and they break down the lyrics, they break down the musical accompaniment, they break down if they hear ad-libs, if they hear silence, you know, kind of, you know, what do these things signify, and what are they trying to do in order to present a particular type of message. So that is the pop cultural part. The literary part is they're actually looking at contemporary Southern Black writers who have said in previous interviews that they have been influenced by Outkast music. So, for example, we are looking at Key S.A. Lehman's novel, Long Division, and the opening of that novel starts with a lyric from Andre 2000 in the album Aquemini.
Twice upon a time, there was a boy who died and lived happily ever after, but that's another chapter.
So particular songs, we'll listen to those and think about, you know, this idea of storytelling and how Outkast's interpretation of storytelling can be extended into critically analyzing what Key S.A. Lehman is doing in his novel. We're also looking at Jesmyn Ward and her novel Where the Line Bleeds, and that also points to Southern hip-hop. And we are finishing the semester with Stankonia and Speaker Box, The Love Below, and thinking about how their influence has influenced other Southern popular culture representations of blackness. So Donald Glover's Atlanta, for example. Mm-hmm. So we'll be looking at Atlanta, looking at the visualization of what some of those things look like, and also looking at their film Outkast. So trying to cover almost all the bases. You can only do so much in one semester, but at least kind of showing students it's more than just the music. There's an actual cultural impact that this group has had in very profound ways.
Well, I will listen to them much differently, and Regina, I thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed our conversation.
Regina Bradley, she's a writer, researcher, and assistant professor at Armstrong State University, where she is currently teaching Outkast and the Rise of the Hip-Hop South. There's more on the class and a link to her Outkasted Conversations podcast. That's at wordofmouthradio.org.
Between Saturday night and early Sunday morning, I don't know, I'm somewhere stuck in between.
Word. Mouth.
Word of 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 mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Deadlines can be stressful and motivational. Many of us need a hard end to let go or to know when something is finished. That idea drives a number of creative community-based challenges that have grown popular in recent years. NaNoWriMo, or National Novel Writing Month in November, which we've talked about on this program. The 48-hour film project, which is pretty much exactly as it sounds. And another event created right here in New Hampshire, RPM, or the Record Production Month Challenge, which officially began on February 1st. Producer Taylor Quimby is following one of the musicians who's taking up the RPM Challenge, and he's here to talk a little bit about how it works. Hi, Taylor.
Hello, and I'm just going to test my levels here real quick because I'm also playing engineer right now. But hi, hello.
Oh, Taylor, thank you. Thanks for joining us.
Of course.
So one album, one month, that's it.
That is exactly the idea, that you write, record, and mix an album in the 28 days of February.
And an album equals what? Like how many songs?
So their rules are either 10 songs or 35 minutes. So if you're in like a prog rock band, you could do like one 35-minute song. Or you could get away with doing 10 one-minute super fast pop tracks or something like that. And this event is actually in its 12th year. So back when it started, you had to mail a CD physically into the RPM organization when you were finished.
So nostalgic.
I know. Nowadays, you still can mail the CD, but you can also Dropbox your finished album. And I actually spoke to Dave Karlotsky. He's one of the co-organizers, and he told me a little bit about how this whole thing got started.
When we originally started RPM, it was an offshoot of The Wire, the weekly paper that we put out here on the Seacoast. And so it was a natural sort of extension of the kinds of arts advocacy that we were always involved in. It wouldn't be a contest. There would be no winners. It was just a creative challenge to take the coldest, darkest, most worthless months of the year and use it for something good. And we were really delighted that first year. We had more than 220 bands sign up just from the Seacoast area of New Hampshire. And we ended up with 165 new albums that came in. And that really warmed our hearts.
Have you also done it? Are you a musician?
I am not a musician. I always get asked this question, and I always feel vaguely guilty, but I can't change the fact that I'm not a musician.
If he were a musician, I don't know if he would have come up with this.
I know. It does sound a little masochistic.
Well, why do you think people do it?
Well, I think, you know, it's sort of what you mentioned in your intro. It's that this deadline, even though there's a lot of pressure that comes along with the deadline, it's also very freeing. It forces you to try things that you might not have otherwise tried. And it also forces you to say, okay, this is pretty good. I've got to move on. And then the other thing that Dave said that I thought was really interesting was that it's also freeing in the sense that, you know, if you were to say, well, I'm going to make an album, there's this sort of weird implied thing that, like, why are you doing it? Are you doing it to become a successful musician? Are you doing it to make money? Are you doing it because you want to be loved? And all those things can feel like a real impediment to even starting a project. And this is for fun. It's a total excuse to try something and not feel like you're going to fail if it doesn't sell even 10 albums, you know?
You
can
so
just
it's
do
like
it.
Like a prompt and there's no room for perfection.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, so what does it look like? How does one actually sign up for it?
So what it looks like is basically a pretty bare-bones website. I mean, I think this thing probably hasn't changed much since they started it.
12 years ago?
12 years ago, exactly. It reminds me of early MySpace because you sign up, there's a little profile, you can stick a picture up there, there's a place to upload your music. There are some forums and blogs, so people who are doing it can sort of share tips or kind of be cheerleadery for each other because it is sort of a crazy thing. So it's a really cool kind of community.
After everything's turned in, we celebrate by having a listening party, and that's a really important part of it. So we play one song from every completed album from the geographic area and get everybody together so everybody can hear everybody else's work.
Well, you say the geographic area, and that's because it's kind of like expanded quite a bit beyond the borders of New Hampshire and New England, huh?
It sure has. Yeah, so the second year that we did it, you know, because it was based on a website, we just opened up the restrictions and said that anybody could participate. And we ended up with tremendous participation from all around the globe. We had more than 2,500 groups sign up from all seven continents. We even had a band from Antarctica.
The peripheral and the fiddler ruins you cracked up, busted on 12 show tour. stares on the house like gasoline shadow.
So as established, when you're doing a full album in a month, you cannot hone anything to perfection. But you've decided you're going to follow one of the New Hampshire musicians throughout RPM 2017. So that's the month of February?
Yeah, I skimmed the registration for this year. I sort of listened to a bunch of the tracks for people who had done it before, reached out to a couple people. And so let me introduce you to the person we're going to be following.
Hi, this is Rob.
Hi, Rob. This is Taylor from New Hampshire Public Radio. How's it going?
Hey, thanks for calling. It's going good.
Awesome, awesome. So do you go by RC or Rob?
I do. I go by RC Thomas because of the other Rob Thomas, the vastly more famous one.
Of course.
And it just makes it impossible if you're going to do anything on social media or the internet.
Yeah, so this is RC Thomas, Rob Thomas. He's been doing RPM for a couple years now. He lives just outside of Portsmouth, makes his living as a professional musician. He does like a mix of different types of bands, cover bands, original bands, jam bands. He does weddings, like a lot of musicians these days. He also throws out the occasional YouTube video.
Got a nice soulful voice.
Yeah. I listened to his stuff from last year, and he's got like a bunch of different tracks. They have different sounds. Like there's one has a bit of a Johnny Cash sort of feel to it. He's got a really nice like deep low voice when he wants to.
Gonna find a way tonight. Oh, gonna make it right.
Another track that kind of reminded me of Dave Matthews.
Waiting on a family line.
Or maybe I'm thinking Hootie and the Blowfish.
Allman Brothers or something. And he's come back for another run. That's really encouraging.
Yeah, and he's coming back for another run at a tough time to be attempting RPM.
Yes, it's been an interesting year, only because I had to just recently move my entire recording studio out of my house. Because my wife and I are having a baby in May. So the recording studio room became the nursery. So I lucked out. A good friend of mine had a nice room in his basement. It just needed a little TLC.
So what's your plan? How often are you going to check in with him?
Well, what we're going to do is I'm going to go visit him a couple times throughout the month and sort of just see how things are going. He is going to record some diaries. We'll check back in a couple weeks and see how he's faring, maybe one-third.
And see how often he wants to be keeping a diary for you when he's going to write a whole album.
Yeah, I know. I was like, okay, so you've got to write 10 songs or 35 minutes in 28 days and do all the work that I need you to do for my little radio story.
So. Okay, so he is a masochist.
Yeah, I guess so.
Okay, producer Taylor Quimby. He's going to be following Portsmouth musician R.C. Thomas throughout the RPM Challenge this month. We are already a few days into February, but it is not too late to sign up. But TikTok, do not wait any longer. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you for spending a little of your precious weekend listening with us. Music in this episode came to us from Broke for Free and Poddington Bear. And there's a lot more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. We're also on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio and on Twitter at Word of Mouth. And we invite you to browse through our growing body of podcasts here at the Creative Unit. We've got Civics 101, the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop, Outside In, and of course, the Word of Mouth Podcast. Any of them searchable on iTunes or wherever you kids are getting your podcasts these days. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue, Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public Radio.
Well, I can amend this hole in my heart. Too many places and stars.